Probably a lot of other places.
Also locally here from a few miles away, which, by the way, is not coincidentally why you're going to have to put up with me. The person who should be giving this talk is Bjarne Stroustrup, the inventor and creator of C++ over these past, oh, I guess it's 30 years now. And he had to be in Europe, so you'll have to put up with me as a poor substitute to give you a very brief overview, because it's a short-bounded talk, about where C++ is, what it's like today. And I really would like to give you just a flavor of that in just a few minutes. So that'll go by pretty fast, because I assume you guys know about programming language design. That's what this conference is about. But maybe you haven't seen C++ recently. And then I want to talk a bit about language design goals, since that's what we're mostly interested in. How does C++ see the world and why, and how does that compare to other mainstream languages? So let me start with the fact that, or the quote from Bjarne, which is C++ 11, which is the new ISO standard that was just published a few months ago, late last year, feels like a new language. The reason it feels like a new language is the features that were added and the library features that were added as well as to the language really have changed the coding style, idiom, and guidance that we give C++ developers in many ways, while still retaining 100% backward compatibility. It's just now we have new ways, and certain things are just, we don't teach people to do that code anymore, but we still support it. It still works, high fidelity. But because style and idiom has changed, that's why it feels new, because that's really what defines a language, is the experience you get when using it. And if you look at all the features that C++ has added in C++ 11, there are quite a few of them, variadic templates, all sorts of things. But there's really only a very small number, which I'm going to give you a taste of, that really will be something that people use pervasively, that will affect probably every 5 or 10 line code example. And so it was a good thing to start with these ones as indicative of a flavor of modern C++. So here's an example which I've riffed off Steven Lavavey, who is in our C++ compiler team. His initials are STL, and that's what he works on and loves. And so we appreciate his contributing this code that kind of shows you what you might do if you have 3 strings that you want to flip in an asynchronous way, join with everything, and then print things out deterministically. And I didn't even have to have a separate function, but I did it for pedagogical reasons in order to show a particular feature called move semantics. So the first thing I want you to notice about the code is that it's quite clean. But let's see some of the features that it shows that are new in C++. One of the features that is not new is the idea of stack lifetime semantics, which does not necessarily mean stack allocation. There's lots of heap allocation here going on, but it's all tied to a stack frame and deterministically cleaned up at the end of that frame in an ordered way, which is faster, it's exception safe, so you don't have to write any try catches much of the time. And in C++ in general, exception safety has almost never been about writing try catch in the right places. It's been about writing destructors in the right place, making sure they fire in the right places. And in code like this, it's just naturally exception safe. No, you don't have to write that space anymore, so people can stop making the jokes. If you don't know what I'm talking about, you don't want to know. Now, I mentioned an asynchronous world, which is very important going forward. And so we have in the standard the concept of threads and mutexes, but also of a nice little simple launcher called async, where the default policy is on this or another thread, which is exactly what you want for a work-stealing runtime, which is what we've implemented it on in our release of our compiler right now. And of course, when you have an asynchronous operation of any kind, you get a future, a ticket redeemable for, in this case, a string. And this is also being widely used throughout programming languages, throughout the industry, and is a very nice model. In C++ 11, futures provide blocking behavior. You can get or wait. And we're also now proposing for the next round, Microsoft in particular, proposing that we add the non-blocking, which is the dot then and wait any wait all, and an await language feature, which is right from C sharp for ISO C++. But it's the blocking part that's in the standard now, the non-blocking part coming soon. So we're launching these 3 things, and we've launched them as Lambda functions, which are now also in every modern mainstream language. Java finally is getting them. Thank you, I've been rooting for that for a long time, because you should. People need this. And people wondered when the free lunch was over and we went to multi-core, is this going to be the time when functional languages take over the world? And the answer is yes. Not because the world is switching to functional languages, but because we're stealing the key ideas from functional languages shamelessly and bringing them into the immutability, Lambda functions, bringing them into our mainstream imperative languages, and that's been very successful. So lambda functions are here. You can have capture by reference or by value for individual variables. You don't have to write your long for loop to visit every element anymore. Range for each, is now in the language, as is automatic type deduction. So you no longer have to repeat types most of the time. When you're declaring a variable, you can just say auto, because the compiler already knows the type of the expression. And it's not helping you or giving you any advantage to make you say it over again. So you'll be seeing auto a lot in new C++ code. One of the reasons that I made the asyncs call a separate function flip was just to demonstrate an important feature in C++ that you almost will never see in code. It is probably the most important single feature in C++ that we added, and yet it doesn't change the code you write except the style of how you write functions. You will be writing pass by value, return by value much more often, and it will be blazing fast and it will not create temporaries. That's the short version. There's much more, but that's the condensed line. And basically what has happened is C++ has always been about supporting both value-like types, which do deep copies and carry values, and reference types. You hold on to by a pointer, do virtual function calls, that kind of thing. And it's always supported them both, but with an emphasis on value-like types. By default, we'll generate copying and things like that. But it turns out a lot of the time when you make a copy, you didn't really mean to make a copy because you're not going to really change it, or you're not going to use the original anymore, you're just passing it off to somebody else, and you do a deep copy only to throw away the original. Well, now in many cases, even without you saying anything extra, we will notice you're not going to use that variable anymore, we'll just steal its guts, it becomes an organ donor, and we'll just take its representation. So that, for example, when I take a string by value as a parameter to flip, you'll notice what I'm actually passing is a temporary object that is constructed from a string literal. So I construct the string once, I move its guts, so I'm not doing a deep copy, another allocation, I'm simply copying the pointer and size and length into flip. When I return, I'm not going to use that value anymore, so I'm returning a string, I have bi-value semantics, but I'm not going to perform an additional deep copy. I'm just going to, again, move the string out to what the async returns, and it's going to move into the future and then back out into get, and this program creates three strings. Ever. But I have bi-value semantics everywhere, which are very clean, they're very easy to reason about. So I get, in move semantics, you might think of it as an optimization of copy. You get the semantics of value types, no pointers. You use pointers a lot less because of this. Declared lifetime, with the efficiency of reference types, because you don't get the deep copying. That's a talk in itself, but it gives you a flavor. And we print out hello lang.next, since we flip the three strings and then output them in a deterministic order, even though they could have run in some other order. We remember the futures in the order that we launched them, and then we print them out. Now, in this particular case, you may say, well, that flip function doesn't do very much. Isn't that really worth sending over to a thread pool? Well, that's okay, because all I've done is express that this could be asynchronous. If the function is small, this is what a work-stealing runtime is great for. It will just inline it. By default, it will run it on the original thread. So this will run work on other cores or on other processors only if there's A, free available resources at that particular moment for the scheduler, and that it's worth bringing over somewhere else. If I actually change this function to, say, translate to French the string, I flip it and then translate it, which could be a local compute-intensive computation, or it could be some web service called a Bing translator or something like that. Now, if it's a higher latency operation, I'll get the latency hit once because I've said I'm going to be doing these things asynchronously. And if it's a Bing translator call, I'll be waiting concurrently. If it's a compute-intensive computation, I'll spread it across three cores and, again, parallelize it. Either way, having expressed the asynchronous work in a very easy way allows me to get that efficiency. And again, we love work stealing, by the way, because it's inline by default. That's what we're about, which I'll talk about more in a second. One thing I actually had to add a slide for shared pointer and the smart pointers, because so far my examples haven't even used pointers. But when you do need pointers, you do want heap allocation. Now we have standard shared pointer and weak pointer, standard smart pointers that you can use and should use. And the guidance we are telling people now is you should not write naked, new, or delete anymore, including delete. Did you notice I said delete? The guidance we give people now is you do not write delete anymore. That changes style a lot. And to paraphrase a slide I gave at the beginning of a build talk about this, it gives you another example side by side. C++ 98 code on the left, C++ 11 code on the right, there's a difference. The code on the right is not only cleaner, it's also safer and faster. In particular, we saw auto, type deduction, I don't need to repeat types. I use make shared instead of new. So P is actually a shared putter of widget, but I didn't have to type it. Why type the type of a variable? You won't have to say shared putter most of the time, except in interfaces. When I have a function that loads the shape, I can just go ahead and return that vector, could be a vector of a million elements by value. And that's okay. There's no copying memory spike. It's efficient because of move semantics. Oh, and by the way, I'll just use auto again to deduce the type of the variable, but that's a vector of shared putter, not of raw pointers. Which means that if you just look at those first two lines, now by construction, I've done all this heap allocation. I've got all this rich object structure. And I said, by the way, by construction, it's tied to the stack frame, and it'll be automatically cleaned up. I don't care if the exceptions get thrown. I don't care what else you might do. I guarantee, by construction, that this program is going to collect, if it be efficient, and be deterministic and ordered in how it does its cleanup. We have the new range for loop, of course, and again, another poster child for auto type deduction. And at the end, again, like I said, we don't need to delete. There's no delete here anywhere. It's automatic and safe, whereas the left-hand side, in addition to being a lot more code, and you had to do the deletes yourself, which is C++98 code, it's also not safe because if an exception gets thrown, you're going to leak memory and objects are going to not be destroyed. So all I would like you to remember, please, is that if you've seen C++ before and you think of C++ as the left-hand side, C++ is now a different language. This is not your father's C++. The code on the right is modern C++, and that's what we're going to be talking about going forward. So with C++ 11, modern C++ code is clean and safe and fast, as clean and safe as any other modern language, and Bjarne explicitly told me to add the sub-bullet when used in a modern style, because the left-hand code is still legal C++. We just don't tell people to do that anymore, but we have a great backward compat story. But that's not C++ anymore. This modern and safe code is. And it's also faster than it's ever been before because of move semantics. You don't have to worry about temporary variables nearly so much or at all. We get other efficiency features such as constexpr, which does a lot of the stuff that Walter just talked about compile time execution of functions. And so it's all about how do we even build further on the core strength of speed. So that was a really short 10-15 minute overview of what C++ 11 is like. And the main takeaway is not any particular feature, but just notice the code's shorter, terser, simpler, clearer, safe, type and memory safe, and still screaming fast. So that brings us to the part that I think is interesting from a language design point of view, is why is C++ the way it is? And I'm going to focus on C++, but also other languages. In particular, you've been hearing all conference long about native and managed languages and their different trade-offs. And what is a native language? And what is a managed language? And a funny thing happened to me on the way to this talk, because as I was coming in the room, someone said, did you know there's an argument going on the other side of that wall where people are in each other's throats and there's blood on the floor about what is native and what is managed? Okay, that was true except for the blood and the violence. But the argument was going on, and it's something we've been talking about for 15 more years. So I'm not going to use those words because they're not useful. They mean different things to different people. So I'm going to talk about two specific data points, and that is what are C++'s design sensibilities as from a language point of view, and some common contrast them to some common ones in Java and .NET, in particular, Java and C#. Values and tenets. Values, what we think is important. Tenets, what we believe. We think performance and control are things that we will never compromise on in C++. If in the future, 20 years from now, somebody else, we've all retired, somebody else is running the standards committee, and they add some feature that violates that, I would call that not C++ anymore. That would be violating the entire spirit of C++. It's all about we will never compromise on performance and control, and we believe in trust the programmer and the zero overhead principle and a few other things. So in particular, that first thing on performance and control, efficient abstraction has always been a cornerstone of C++, because our world is built on layers and layers of abstractions. It's the only way we know to build big systems. And systems are only getting bigger, not smaller. Given that you're going to have these layers, we feel it's our job to make those layers as thin as possible or even disappear, the overheads of having expressed all that rich abstraction. The flexibility to say exactly what you want, to not assume, well, the programmer will never need to do that, so we'll just not allow that option. By default, unless there's a reason that we shouldn't include it, we won't arbitrarily restrict the generality of language features, such as templates. We'll always allow people to have control over the memory layout and the exact arrangement of their program, which is more important than ever in a multi-core world. And determinism and ordering, so that when I read my code, I know exactly what I get. Things are scoped. I know exactly the meaning of the code. Now, what do we believe in? Those are values. What are some other things we believe in that follow from trust and zero overhead? The first is, leave no room for a language lower than C++. So even at Microsoft, when we talked about designing language extensions, C++ CLI, C++ CX, that was our stated goal, one of our key goals, to make sure that even in the extensions to standard C++, leave no room for someone to use a different language because it gave better performance efficiency or better access to the underlying system. That is our bread and butter. Zero overhead, so if I don't use a feature, I shouldn't be incurring overheads for people who do because I'm not that person. So why should I pay for you? Trust the programmer. Now, this one's often abused because people will say, that's where all the pitfalls come from. I don't want to be trusted. This is not intention with having guardrails that are on by default. You can still have guardrails and good semantics, deterministic semantics. This is more about not arbitrarily limiting what the programmer can do and providing a safe default, but always giving him a way to open the hood and say, I know what I'm doing. I need to do this, and then saying, okay, we trust you. If you say so, if you opt in and say, I know what I'm doing, we will let you control the engine. We will give you the steering wheel. So those last two parts are very closely tied. I could talk about a lot of examples, but let me give you just one recent one. You might have noticed the GPGPU is probably the most popular form of heterogeneous computing where the same program runs on different kinds of compute cores right now. This is something any modern language can do, C#, Java, and you can find some solutions that approach this space, but by far the majority of them are extensions of C++ and C, OpenCL, CUDA, C++ AMP. Why? It's not because managed languages and others can't do that. Some are doing it and more will, but why is C++ first to the party? Why did, for instance, we, in a very busy product cycle, I mean, the last 2 years have been a tsunami, and our team has sort of been in the middle of it at Microsoft because in the sense that the tablet revolution, the whole change to a COM-based model for WinRT for an old Windows API, GPGPU and heterogeneous cores, and several other things are happening overlapped at the same time. Our industry is in convulsion. And when you're the tool that everybody relies on, you get to be convulsed. And so it's been a bit of a hurricane. And yet in that time, we also, despite being super busy, also shipped C++ AMP specifically to enable people to write code that gets spread across GPGPU. Why would we take that on when we're already busy? Because the installed base is an enormous carrot. This is not about just GPGPU. But if you look at the installed base of desktop and notebook machines and the most modern tablets as well, those have a huge number, something like 50% or so of the installed base already have a compute class GPU built into them because it's a graphics card, which now can be used for computation. So the mainstream, our view of what the mainstream machine is, should already include those cores as something you could spread your program onto. It is our job to give you access to the hardware. We weren't doing it. You could argue that C and C++ were not doing their job of giving you full access to exploit the full hardware if we couldn't touch those cores, which for many workloads gave you a 1040x speed up if your workload was just right. That's why you saw C++ go in this direction first. Other languages will too, but it reflects our priorities, and I thought it was an interesting example. Now, it's interesting because even at this conference, I've noticed this, and I've seen this play out now since the mid-1990s, where you have some people who are sort of performance heads, like I am gladly admit to being one of, who say, you know, I like my guardrails and programmer productivity too. Just like I showed you, modern C++ is clean and safe as well as fast. But I'll never do any feature like that at the expense of incurring overheads on people who don't use it. So you have that group of people. And then you have other sane people who very legitimately make a different choice, and they say, you know, I want to work with you, I love you, but my priority is I will also provide performance and control. I'll de-virtualize. I'll have aggressive jitting to try to make it back. But I am never going to go away from by default or always on guardrails and programmer productivity first in the name of performance. I deliberately opt for those things first. And then you have these two people in the room, and you think that they kind of have trouble getting along sometimes because they think they're talking about different things. And I don't think that's true at all. Because the perception that many people have is that in language design, you can have this Venn diagram where if you want performance and control, you pick from this set of language features. And if you want to emphasize programmer productivity as your primary target, then you have this other set of language features. And there's this little overlap. And then you have these people who are in the room who are saying, no, I'm right. No, you're right. And they have an argument. And then there are fights and who gets the children. And it's just horrible. Because there was a book written about this that says we should understand that we just view things differently, but we can still stay together and work together very effectively. So it could be that performance geeks are from Mars and always want to fix a performance problem, and that productivity-oriented people who have placed a value on that may have better social skills or just be able to reach a broader number of people or something. That it's not an either-or thing. The question is this really true? This is the perception. Is this really true? And I dispute that. I do not believe it's true at all. I believe the correct picture is something like this, and probably even closer, but I wanted to make it visible that there were some areas of non-overlap. Because if you look at almost any major feature in mainstream languages, they exist in this intersection. Lambda functions, for each, futures, async, await, other things apply just as well to C++ as to, say, Java and C#. All these languages benefit from these things and should and will and have got them. None of these features is in the set of things where there is a tension between performance and productivity. You can get both. And if we can get our cake and eat it too, isn't that the best place to be? This is the free zone, and almost everything falls into this category. Now, there are trade-offs to be made, but look at the richness in the free zone. And the star, the asterisk, is things that are not yet in the C++ standard, but that we're already actively working on for our next standard as well. So now let's talk about so-called native and so-called managed, and I won't use those terms because really I want to be more specific because those things mean different things to different people. Let's talk about C++ priorities and say .NET, C#, Java style priorities, both of which are a consistent and well-founded set of priorities for solving different problems. In the Java and .NET style world, the focus is on productivity, and so they've decided wisely to opt in to certain overheads that are there whether a particular program exercises them or not, because we believe we control the costs. The costs are overhead is low enough in most cases, and it will greatly benefit everybody, and that your amortized costs will be much greater as you gain programmer productivity in the long run. So we're going to assume garbage collection is always on or on by default. Often you can turn it off, but now you're starting to work against the spirit of the language rather than with it. We're going to assume a virtual machine is there by default. Yes, we can compile to native code, but we're assuming usually there's virtual machine in JIT, and the language is designed for that. And as we're using that, we're working with it. Always on metadata, whether we use it or not. So a lot of reflection-based tools are enabled by that. But there's cost, but there's also huge productivity. That's a great and consistent set of choices. At the same time, C++ has said, we'll also give you type safety and memory safety, but we're going to do it through smart pointers that you have to opt into. And we recommend you do, but you have to say, you're not going to get cost unless you ask for it. So please ask for unique pointer and shared pointer. And I put garbage collection with an asterisk because that is not yet in the C++ standard, and I'm going to be proposing it. And it's not what you're probably thinking. There is an important need for garbage collection for certain high performance algorithms. Reference counting with smart pointers is great for everything we're doing now. We're very happy with that world, and that's where we're going to stay. If you are in a few rare cases, you are doing, for instance, low-level code to implement a lock-free data structure, such as even a singly linked list. It turns out that unless you have garbage collection for the nodes, you have ABA problems, for example, and there's a few other categories where high-performance code really would like garbage collection, but only for this small and bounded set of objects where I opt into it. If I never say GC alloc, I get zero overhead. If I say GC alloc and I get back a pointer, I call it again, get back another pointer, I get collection only for those pointers. I don't search every pointer in the system. I get collection that's accurate, that I can rely on portably, but only for those pointers. That's what I want to add. Not let's switch to GC for everything. Let's add GC to what we already have. We're very happy with reference counting. Let's stay there. But let's now also enable portable ISO C++ code to write efficient, scalable, lock-free algorithms that you can compile on any platform under the sun. So, but it's a difference in perspective and emphasis. Another category is the default assumptions that are made. I got a lot of flack in the last 48 hours for blogging that, .NET and Java assume virtual functions by default. And the first thing people said is, but they're not default in C# if you write a class. That's not the point. It's that the whole environment is designed around uses of virtual functions, from console write line, calling toString virtually, through to generics in Java and .NET, which are nothing but virtual dispatch. They're engineered around that. And there's, because of that, there's things that tend to work better when you also have JIT, making that a nice set of design choices. But I assume I have virtual dispatch. I assume my object layout is dynamic, because that gives me some efficiencies and also lets me be opaque to other code. I assume in managed world that things are non-deterministic, such as collection of memory, and that are unordered. For example, if I collect objects that own resources, finalization is unordered. This is not like destructors. Now, the recommendation these days is don't use those, but for better or worse, that's what they're there for, and the idea of being non-deterministic and unordered was part of the package that was opted into. Because if I give some of that flexibility up so the programmer doesn't have to worry about it, is the hope, there can be other gains to be had. In C++, the default assumptions are inline by default. Every template, every call you make in a template is inlined by default. I can have virtual functions, but I say virtual when I call them, but all the genericity is compile time, is static and inline by default. My object layout is predictable. In fact, remember how when you add a new member to a C++ class, a private member that nobody can call, but you add it, you still have to recompile the world? We pay that price because having the compiler know the object layout, even though it's type memory safe, it's type safe because you can't touch that private member, but because we always guarantee the compiler can, that is a root decision from which a lot of the optimizability and inlineability comes from. The ability for the compiler to efficiently, without doing NP-complete analysis, can make choices and optimize the application. We talked about determinism, say stack-based allocation. We usually tie lifetimes to objects' lifetimes to other objects' lifetimes, directly held members, stack allocation. We tear things down in order. And as an example from the library, in our standard library in the STL, you might notice that nearly all of the algorithms, the member functions on containers, actually state the big O order of operations. What Java or C# programmer generally cares about that? How often do you see that documented there? But that's fine, that's a different target. The C++ programmer, it was felt important enough to document it by default as opposed to document it occasionally when it's sometimes important, but to document it by default. It went to a lot of trouble to document the big O complexity of every single algorithm in the standard library. One last bucket. The managed side would tend to favor simplifications for the programmer, and I should say the Java C# style side. So for example, lambdas are in the intersection where you could do byref or byvalue capture in any language. So far, from what I've seen, at least in C#, it's byref capture always, which simplifies the model. People don't have to think about is it byref or byvalue. You can argue whether there's bugs that people write and have to learn, but it's simpler, right? And so that's a good choice. Doesn't mean C# can't go back and add byvalue capture also and let you choose, but it's indicative where here we choose a smaller set of the feature, whereas here we choose the full feature and allow full control, because C++ is in the business of not telling you you can't do something. You can always say what you want to say. The idea of generics that are written in one shot, in C#, for example, in .NET, you have to write a generic once. You can't specialize it for, here's my generic, but if T is a cat or a shape, then use this other implementation of a generic. There's no sense of non-type generic parameters. For instance, passing a number to a generic, to say for a fixed size array, how big it should be. Whereas those are the default in C++, where you can specialize templates, and you can go through and provide compile time information to them, compile time parameters to them, like integers. One that I just discovered while doing this talk, and so thank you for Brian, who's in the audience, and to Christoph and a few others for educating me and making sure I got this right. So hopefully I got this right. I was going to use hash-based containers as an example, because in standard C++, we now have hash-based containers. And when you use a hash container, you care very much about what? Load factor, and how good is your hash function, right? In C++, Java, and .NET, you can control the load factor. You can say what the load factor is. In C# and Java, that's where it ends. You say it once at construction, you cannot change it later. As far as I'm aware, correct me if I'm wrong, but my current impression is you cannot change it later. You cannot say, make sure you rehash now to at least this much. If I know I'm about to enter a million elements and I want to guarantee there are no pauses during that time, rehash pauses as I'm upgrading number of buckets, I know of no way to control that. And it's interesting because there's no reason you can't do that in C# and Java. In fact, as soon as I asked for it, the response was, oh, that's a nice idea. Maybe we should add that. Nobody's asked for it, which shows they're doing the right thing for their customers, right? There isn't that same need. Whereas in C++, we added hash-based containers. First thing we did is add the ability to control the load factor and to query it at any time, so you can change it. And that you can pre-allocate to be guaranteed that you can go through a set of operations and inserts without a pause, without the overhead of rehashing in the middle. Just like Vector has always given you the ability to change the capacity so you can insert a million elements and know you're not going to reallocate during that time. And one other thing that's given is iterators give you the normal iteration over the container, but there's also a set of bucket iterators where you can actually iterate and look inside the data structure to see exactly how big each bucket is and what's in each bucket. And that's intended purely in debug mode. I don't know when you'd use that at runtime, but you might, but it's there because we're not going to question. Just because we can't think of why they might use it doesn't mean we won't give it to them. We know at least at debug time, people may want to know how good their hash function is for that particular data set, how well it's doing. So you can iterate over the buckets. So when we add features like that are actually in the intersection, we might choose to just add it in a way that naturally, for this set of customers, you want to make sure you give full control. And by default, hash-based containers look the same in both languages, are used exactly the same, often with identical syntax, character for character in both languages. But we always let you open the hood and take more control if you want to, even though you still have the simple default. Now, how big are these different languages? I did an interesting study, because I was curious, and so I looked it up. And it's hard to tell, like, what is the complexity of a language or library. So as proxies of that, I used specification size by number of pages and also by word count in specifications. If you look at the C++ 98 standard, most of it, well, about half, but a little more than half, was in the library. The rest was the language. Compared to KNRC, both had grown quite a bit. So this is to scale by page count, in this case, because page count was all I had for KNRC. And the 1990 C++ standard in particular that's about the relative size. C++ 11 has added some to the language, even more to the library, and to scale, this is about where they are, added more to the language than the library, and this is again to scale. Question, how big is C# and Java, just on the language side, how big are C# and Java compared to C++ 11 in specification word count? Bigger. Somebody said bigger. Yeah, C++ is bigger. I know Charles likes us, but seriously, who do you think is smallest, C#, Java, or C++? Java's the smallest, C#. Some C++, because if I'm up here, you know the answer has to be C++, right? It's not. Okay. This is an unbiased look at it, because I just wanted to know what the answer was, not the answer I wanted to hear. If you look at C# 3.0 from 2008, by word count, it was slightly less, about 5% less, than the current C++ standard. And it's about 1,000 words more. I think it's 179 to 180,000 is the difference. Words more than C++ 11, virtually identical. Now, word count does not tell you everything, because there's complexity, there's interdependencies and things like that. But as a rough proxy, we look like we're in the noise. Java is roughly the same, slightly bigger, Java 7 2011 spec. Isn't it interesting that this does not prove the big intersection, but it sort of qualitatively comes from the fact that we have this big intersection where we're adding many of the same features, for each and lambdas and var and all those cute things. And isn't it interesting that, in fact, we have ended up, at least by one way of measuring it, in much the same space in terms of complexity of a mainstream modern language. Now, let me continue, because there is more to be said there, because there are unspecified things in all three of those, for example. But even more so, I would point to interactions. That's where you're going to get even more, because how do you measure complexity? So I'm taking a very simple proxy. So for the first two decades of C++, it was in research, and then it went into the mainstream. And this third decade was one where my former boss said coffee-based languages, so sorry, not meant to be a bad word. It's just that's what he kind of called them, because that was his experience. And the idea of the managed languages, we want to now go for productivity first. The outstanding question, which was a very important question, is can they solve all important problems so that native code, C and C++, would really be just for device drivers anymore? Is that possible? Nobody knew what the answer was 15 years ago. So something happened that is sort of indicative of the answer to me. When I first joined Microsoft in 2002, and shortly after that, an edict came down. And the edict from Jim Alchin, who was then head of Windows, said all new APIs in Windows will be managed. .NET. We'll also do some native APIs, but never instead of. That'll be in addition to, never instead of managed APIs. And this is one of the reasons we scrambled to do C++ CLI, because you want to stay relevant on the platform, right, because of this choice. It turns out that as Windows tried to create this managed surface area, you might realize Longhorn had problems which were related or unrelated, and went through a reset, after which we took the road to Vista, after which we went reset to a known code base, and then went back to add things that were met reliability, robustness, out-of-memory hardening standards, serviceability standards, and the managed API never materialized back. In fact, in this release, we are now doing essentially what we tried to do in Windows with Longhorn. Provide an object-oriented API, but it's built in reference counting native code COM. So it's interesting, because this was a very important experiment, because it helped us to answer the question of really what are the limits? Can managed code solve every problem? And at least at that point in time in the mid-2000s, it couldn't. We went through a great part of our industry where we were processor constrained, and so an app that was twice as efficient would be twice as fast or get twice as many users on a time sharing system or something like that. Then we went through this phase where we had two things. We had surplus local compute broadly available in the mainstream, and UI innovation had stalled for a while. We were satisfied with WIMP interfaces, and we were building other things instead. During that time, programmer time was the main constraint, and managed languages appropriately optimized for that. And that category, that class of things isn't going away, but a few other things have happened since. We've now gone to another pairing of going to mobile, smaller form factors with smaller hardware requirements, and at the same time asking them to do even more with new user experiences. There, a twice as efficient app now will get twice the battery life and or twice the compute speed. When you go to cloud and data center, by far the biggest cost is server hardware and power. It's 88% of the total cost, and you will get an app that runs in half the size cloud. When you go to heterogeneous cores like GPGPU, again, power, especially as we get to dark silicon problems, is a constraint and processor, and again, we get to half power or twice the compute throughput in a native language if your app can be twice as efficient. And when Moore's Law is over, it'll be twice as fast forever, locally. It seems to me that those last four are going to dominate the mainstream for the rest of our careers. That doesn't mean there isn't room for other things. There are many other interesting problems, and often these aren't the only constraints. But it is indicative of the kind of problem that still needs a good solution in language support. And so in other customer email, we were just having another discussion, and Nicholas yesterday gave me permission to use this quote. In another context, he was saying, when the business model is to charge for CPU hours, and that is the business model for the cloud, we had better give people an efficient language. Also, James Hamilton, who knows quite a bit about data centers, pointed out, and it was his study I quoted, that when you go from enterprise to the cloud, people costs have gone from top to nearly irrelevant because it's mostly hardware and power. What matters is work done per dollar and work done per watt. And you saw Andre say the same thing yesterday in the panel, where watt per user, when was that ever a measure before? And the third point is interesting. The things we're doing now in the data center are coming back into the enterprise as we're using the same models and following the same principles we're learning there and applying them for in-house enterprise systems. One last thing. We talk about the C++ renaissance in the industry, and I get various reactions to that. Are you sure? Are people really using C++ more? Is it just Microsoft waking up and realizing we've all been using it all along? No, there really is a hockey stick. And as one measure, we did a survey 2 months ago, and we asked people, among other things, how long have you been working on your current application? How old is your current application? 10 years or more, 30%. 5 to 9 years, 20%. This is what you would expect. It's all this old C++ code. And 50% were in 0 to 4 years. That is the C++ renaissance right there. And that was with a good sized data set. And we think that's representative of the industry. So find your biggest costs and optimize that. If it's programmer time, use a language that's suited to that. That's a good tool and a good use of it. If it's power and efficiency or control, use a language optimized for that. That's a good use. Don't try to turn one into the other because it's not a good fit. So strong abstraction, control, and efficiency, and to end with a quote from our next speaker, the going word at Facebook is that reasonably written C++ code just runs fast. Especially C++ 98 code is more difficult to write in other languages, but efficient code has always been a lot easier. And with that, that's the value proposition of C++, and we think that's something that we should continue to focus on while still also adding much of that rich subset of features that we have in common to make programmers productive and make things safe as well as fast. I don't know if we have any time for a question, but thank you, Maz, for inviting to a managed conference, what has been until this year. It's nice to be able to be looking at native code and its value or where it fits in the whole ecosystem.
Thanks. Let's take a question too, just because I am soft today.
So you mentioned the cost of having things on by default, like safety checks, for example, but you didn't mention the externality, which is if people are writing C++ code that's unsafe, all the security vulnerabilities, and that's actually that cost to the economy at large completely dwarfs the cost to programmers.
So there's absolutely a trade-off here. Anybody who thinks that this is the mistake that both C++ and managed developers have made the last 15 years. There have been people in both camps who say, no, my thing can do the whole job. They're both wrong. That's falling into the trap that is of saying one size fits all, which is based on and based with the idea that there are no trade-offs. There are trade-offs. And the question is, do you want an application that can run at 10 hours on a mobile processor or not? Do you want a data center application that runs at half the cost or not? Both, there are good reasons to use each. One of the key things I hope that I was pointing out here is that C++ 98 code, and C code especially, was much weaker. But modern C++, when used in a modern style, is not just clean code to write and read, but is type safe and memory safe by default now. And we should not be doing deletes anymore by hand. If we are, that's bad. We should not be writing things that assume sizes of buffers anymore. If we are, that's bad. So absolutely we should be guiding people toward using things in a safe way. That's not always in tension with fast.
All right. Well, thanks.
Thank you.